Are you ready? Just a couple of details from last time. We talked about the dream of Descartes that Montfrance wrote, and I just brought it along if you want to have a look through it. It's really half the book, so it's quite a quite an essay. It starts where the marker is. Just pass that around. One thing I needed to correct, if you remember the water that was in the coconuts, he interpreted as the aqua permanens, and I said it was the same as Mercurius, and that's wrong. It's actually the name for the end state for like the liquid form of the lapis. We can come back to that here. I don't necessarily agree with his interpretation. It doesn't really matter, because the important thing is that whatever's inside that coconut is very, very, very important.
That end state of the liquid form of the lapis?
It's the liquid form of the lapis, yeah. Sometimes it was, you know, a gold or diamond, or sometimes it was a magical water. And that water would heal or transform whatever it touched.
Okay.
So I just, you know, it's a detail. I checked it. If you're really an addict, you can look at Anatomy of the Psyche, pages 72, 74, 75 and 79. It's obscure, but I just don't want to leave you with incorrect information.
Now, what were the pages again?
72, 74, 75, and 79.
So, does the permanent water still equal the spirit in matter? You said permanent water equals Mercurius equals spirit and matter.
I think that in a way it is Mercurius, but it's Mercurius in his final state. Remember, Mercurius can be the beginning, middle, or end.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the aqua permanens would be Mercurius as an image of the goal, as an image of the end state. And again, remember in alchemy what's so confusing is everything is everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think on the whole, it would be the end product of what has been extracted from matter. So that what's extracted from matter still needs to go through some change. And when it goes through change, then it would be aqua permanens.
You may have done this, but could you give us more
of
the end state?
Another example.
The end state of what has been extracted.
Well, let's take Pauli's case. The coconuts, I think, would be the feelings of attraction for Montfrance. As we've talked, he was being led into that relationship for his own development, to develop his own feeling, and for the development of his creative work. So had he been able to stick with that relationship, and find a meaning in it, he would have become a different person, and he would have started publishing with her, and that would have been the aqua permanens. That would be the goal of the raw material, which was the coconuts.
Thank you.
Or you could say it would be the diamond, or you could say it would be the gold, or you could say it would be the hermaphrodite. They're all different images. And I think each one shows a different aspect of the redeemed condition. Like, gold would just be that he does something valuable. That's not too hard to figure out. Diamond would just be that he does something imperishable. It's hard. And it's not going to buckle under the pressure of collective rejection or collective criticism. The aqua permanens would be the fact that it flows from one generation to the next. and probably that it would add some flow to his own life, which was probably, must have been very dry. He was addicted to ice cream. He got hugely overweight. And you can just see that's the sweetness that was missing. So that I think that flow would have been a way of living that was more satisfying.
You said the diamond was...
The imperishability. That Jung is dead and we're still talking about him. And people attack him, as we've seen, and he keeps on going. I think that's the diamond. Gold is malleable, so you don't quite get the toughness of the redeemed personality in the image of the gold. You get the high value, but not the diamond. I think that's why there are so many different images for the end state, because it's all trying to capture the different aspects, metaphorically said, of what we're trying to accomplish. Yeah.
Gary, just you reminded me, I mentioned the textbook on Jung last time. It's
right.
A wonderful article by Camilla Paglia, the feminist. She wrote this fabulous article on the essential need for Jung to be part of humanity's curriculum.
Wow.
It's a beautifully written piece, and she uses Neumann. Eric Neumann's work is an example.
How long is it?
How long is it? Yes, it's in the pages.
Why don't you make us each a copy?
Okay.
Or give me a copy, and I'll put it up on my website, and people can download it either way.
Just beautiful.
Where was it?
It was in the ION, which is the Journal of the Humanities, Arts and Letters.
Yeah.
And she, it was a speech she gave, and then she published this, and it's just beautifully written about this need that we have. And what reminded me was when you said that everything is everything, she said we try to get so definitive that we no longer can keep these big images that allow for all of this movement. And so she talks about Jungian archetypes and then uses Jungian as an example.
It's a recent edition of that magazine?
You know, I
want to
say it's 10 years old.
Oh, golly. I would even try to buy it if you can give me information about... they must have a website or something.
I'll give you the website. I found it through the Jung website. I was looking up something else, and I found it through that. Anyway, it was just... It was an incredibly beautifully written piece.
Yeah.
The important nature and how she feels that the students in the arts and letters of the past 30 years have been given a raw deal in post-structuralism and post-modernism.
Amen, yeah.
So it's just really... It's,
oh, cool.
She uses Jung and Neumann as an example of how you hold open this whole world that allows for this play that we talk about.
Cool. Does she teach somewhere, or...?
She's teaching... Is she Columbia? She might be...
She's a professor.
Yeah, she's a professor.
She was on Berkman or something. Months ago.
Yeah.
The 3-hour interview.
Was she really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
she's quite a thing.
I mean, a lot of people call her insult. You know, they call her just insulted. And I mean, I was just amazed how she deals with that.
She's a feminist who does not allow people to put in vacuum.
What show was
there that anybody would know?
Bookmates,
48
hours, Friday, Saturday morning
at 8
to Monday at 8.
Is that a TV or radio?
TV. They talk about their books for an hour. They invite everybody. Not novels, but history, politics,
anything.
I don't get cable.
They were at the Unitarian Church about 3 years ago. I didn't know how you would have taken
it. Who was doing it?
Nancy asked who was doing it.
Who was the author of it?
I have it. I have it. I have it. I document everything. I have it.
What spelling of ION do they use for that journal?
What spelling of ION do they use for that journal?
AION.
Same as you. Yeah.
So How did you find out it was who's on BookNet?
I think you can go online and look.
Oh, you can.
I just turned it on.
BookTV.org.
Linda Crawford, you are our internet expert.
Only because the psychiatrist punched it up there for me. He was so impressed with that. I invited her to come.
He says, oh, I go there all the time. He said, you know, she couldn't believe that.
Nancy said it reminds me of what Rollo May said before he got interested in psychology and psychotherapy. He said that, I guess it was probably in the 50s, he was looking around for courses that he might be interested in. And he found that in the seminary, of all places, where Paul Tillich was teaching, there was the most interesting classes that weren't in the regular university. You know, Paul Tillich was teaching like art, and ethics, and coming from the European tradition, and Paul Tillich really was grounded in this Lindemann thing.
Yeah, he spoke at the Aronauts conferences.
That's what turned him on, and it wasn't the university. It was at that time, but these are unique seminaries here.
Well, that's why I went to do it. That's why I went to Divinity School. Exactly why I went. It's the only place I could study what I wanted to study. I wasn't the least bit interested in the church. Graduate Theological Union, Berkeley. It's not the same anymore, but it was then.
Back then.
It's now a preacher factory, I'm afraid, as far as I could tell.
Was he there when you were there?
Tillich? No, but one of his students was our teacher. And just the whole atmosphere was, you could discuss life.
Some groups at the University of Chicago, too.
Well, I think the best schools of religion are like that, yeah.
You know, it's interesting, not to take too much time, but I met with my major professor from 30 years ago from the game last week, and I was telling him about how, I'd read this, and, I said, basically what you've done is just completely dismiss everything I get up for every day.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it's fascinating because they used to have a young conference at Notre Dame, mm-hmm. and we meet with Fred Crossan, who's one of the founders of that, but mm-hmm. it's going on for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Well, Frost came, and everybody, there was anybody, but what he said to me was, he said there was a huge pitched battle between bringing in that whole, what they call this humanistic psychology, that whole, and it included Jung and all of those people back in the 60s and 70s when I was there, and between Skinner and, all of mm-hmm. that stuff that we studied, because he said that your department had to have a focus in order to get money.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the money absolutely came through the scientific end,
mm-hmm.
and that's what universities wanted. They needed the money to support their department.
Mm-hmm.
And he says he thinks a shift is afoot.
Do you know what department Martin Felsen is on? He must have been there when you were there.
Sounds really familiar, but I don't recall it.
He's a young man, a Episcopal priest.
Uh-huh.
I'm not dead, but he was there for many years, like 20 years.
Well, he said those people tended to show up more in the literature department,
mm-hmm.
some in theology, but not in psychology. Mm-hmm. Psychology needed to keep it very rational in order to get the money that it needed to support the department.
Mm-hmm. I told you what, there was a psych professor at Butler. I think I told you that 20 years ago. This is old, but 20 years ago, who was teaching Jung, and she was told by the chair, do not teach anymore Jung.
Mm-hmm.
It's not scientific.
Yeah.
And she left. Excuse me. Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that the diamond is existing somewhere. Couple other details. I came across a wonderful little description of what Pali is afraid of. And Crenshaw de Troyes, depending how you say it. Remember, we're talking about his now meeting von Franz, and that dream of the fear of going in the moonlight, that it wouldn't lead anywhere, and here his resistance to drinking the water, and he wasn't drinking it, the stranger was drinking it, but his whole resistance to objects having a power themselves over you. Remember that? Two last two dreams. Well, here's just a couple of paragraphs I'll read you of what that looks like in a man when objects have control over them. and when they're walking in the moonlight, and what he was so afraid of. And I think it's interesting, this is, I think, what, 12th, 13th century stuff. This is really the first time in the West since the Greeks that men began approaching the anima and began approaching feeling in this, in these medieval texts. This is the tradition of courtly love. So just now, women are becoming not just objects, but subjects. They're idealized, and there are many problems with that. But still, men are having experiences of women which are new, and here's what it looks like. This is from the text called The Knight of the Cart, and the knight in the cart is going along, and they're off to get the queen, to save the queen. And you don't know it here, but eventually you find out that it's Lancelot. So it starts off. Like one powerless and defenseless against love's control. He's just seen his sweetheart. Like one powerless and defenseless against love's control, the knight of the cart fell into such thoughts that he lost thought of himself. He did not know if he was dead or alive, did not remember his own name, and did not know whether he was armed or not, did not know where he was going or whence he was coming. He remembered nothing except one person, and for her he put everyone else out of mind. Then they go on, and they come to a ford where they're going to cross, and there's a guard. So I'm skipping a bit, and then the text continues. The knight on the other side cried out, I guard the ford, knight, and I forbid you to cross. Still preoccupied with his thoughts, the other, Lancelot, did not hear or heed him, and all the while the horse galloped toward the water. The guard cried out to him to turn back. Stay away from the ford, and you will act wisely. That is not the way to cross. By his very heart he swore he would strike him if he went into the water, but the knight heard him not. And so he shouted to him a third time, Knight, do not enter the ford against my command and my will, or on my word I will strike you as soon as I see you there. So wrapped in his thoughts was the knight, Lancelot, that he did not hear him. That's lost my place. They did not hear him, and the horse immediately left the bank and jumped into the water and began to drink in great gulps. The guard declared that the knight would pay for this. His shield on his back would never offer him protection. Then he, the guard, set on his own horse at a gallop, and from the gallop coaxed it to a run. He struck the knight. Lancelot. He struck the knight and laid him flat in the center of the ford he had forbidden him to cross, making the lance fly from his hand and the shield from his neck. The knight in the water shivered as he felt the water. Stunned completely, he jumped to his feet like someone roused from sleep. That's exactly what Pally's defending against. He listened and looked about, wondering who could have hit him. He got so discombobulated, he didn't even know that he had to deal with reality. Catching sight of the knight, he cried out, Vassal, tell me why you struck me. I did not notice you ahead of me and had not wronged you. I swear you did, he answered. Have you not treated me shamefully since I forbade you three times to cross the ford? He goes on and on. And then the Lancelot answers, Damn the man, as far as I'm concerned, who ever heard or saw you. You may well have forbidden me to cross the ford, but I was wrapped in thought. So that's what Pally's afraid of. That's a man walking by moonlight. The rational faculties are gone, and the mind is caught up with imagination and desire and fantasy. A couple other points. I didn't like the answer I gave for what does it mean when he says that Pally doesn't drink the water, the stranger does. Where is that? Down to bottom of 66, the stranger cracks the nut and drinks the clear juice, which transforms him. So remember, in the dream, the stranger drinks the water and the nuts, not Pally, not the dreamer. And I said, rather, not incorrectly, but schematically, that the self was getting nourished. And I think I would like to try to put that a little more clearly, because it's so important that we see what transformation is trying to occur in Pally. That would mean his work would get the nourishment. I think that's the way to make that distinction. Here, the self would be the work that he was to do. And so his ability to be inspired in that work, to have faith in that work, to complete the work, the inner confidence to complete the work, would be what it means when the stranger drinks the water. So even though Pali is getting sucked into this relationship through his personal feelings, what the experience is trying to do is support his impersonal task, his task in the world, not about von Franz as a human being, but as about von Franz, representative of the work that's to be done. Now, of course, he has to go through von Franz as a human being, and that's a layer too. But the fact that the stranger drinks the water shows how we are put into situations which are meant to enhance our meaning, our ability to fulfill our meaning, which in Pali's case was, I felt, to work on this split between spirit and matter, science and spirit. And one more, pass around. This is the biography I mentioned. I guess if you don't read German, you're out of luck. But it's not bad, and it's manageable. Just came out last year. And here's a picture of his home and the view from his writing desk at the top of page 87. I just alluded to that. And that takes us over to page 67. If you got any questions you want to chew on.
So the liquid means, again, what?
Why don't you try it?
It means that's something that gives the meaning.
Yeah, well said.
But why is the stranger doing it? Pally wouldn't.
One hand, Pally wouldn't, but there's a deeper answer.
But why wouldn't the dream say, offer him the drink, and he has to choose? Take it or not take it.
Pally?
Yeah.
Well, it's a crucial feature of Jungian psychology, which is what you're asking about. Yeah, we are addressed. We are addressed.
By the self.
Yeah.
Connect that to this idea, or to the fruits. So.
Let's go back. It wouldn't hurt to reread the dream, because we're going to pick up with it. I see large striped objects lying on the floor. Page 65. It looks similar to coconuts, but are somewhat longer and are of gray-green color. And there's a picture in the back, if you're interested. Now the stranger comes with a big hammer and smashes them one after the other. At that, the stripes vanish. You know, why is that? Because the stranger is one of those moments. Then he takes the broken pieces in his hand. The pieces are like shell-shaped containers, and to my astonishment, I see they contain a liquid, clear like water. The stranger drinks this, immediately becomes progressively younger, his gray hair becoming darker and finally brown. I say it is important that the objects don't have a power of their own. That's why I was trying to show you what that looks like when they do have a power of their own. The juice appears to have the healing power. He nods in the affirmative and asks, when I drink this liquid, I don't need to go to war. Kepler also acted similarly.
So you said that the stranger is a moment.
Well,
a moment when Pauli could have found understanding.
Right. And in other words, his whole experience with Wang Fang was a moment. It was a special moment in his life. And you know what is so amazing? You can see this often in dreams predicted. So that one day somebody calls you up and says, let's go for a coffee, and you blow them off and it's not a big deal. Another day somebody calls you up and says, let's go for a coffee, you blow them off and you've lost a major chance in your lifetime. And that was one of these moments for Pauli. He could not blow her off. Because time was different. It was a more important time in his life. And that's what he doesn't like. There are important moments in life that he has to ask what is being asked of me, and he doesn't go along being the guy in control.
So the fact that the stranger drinks is reflective of that being a certain quality of time,
right,
that's being presented to him.
Right, right. And I think another way to put, that's putting it somewhat philosophically, which is okay. Another way to put it in more ordinary speech is that this is a special moment in his life. And you only get so many special moments. You get more than one, but you don't get 100.
Well, and Carol's question too,
yeah.
The stranger, since he drinks and he's showing him a way to...
Yeah, now, to Ted's question, he's showing him that this experience of Von Franz is meant to nourish your work. Putting it in the most simple way. Putting it in a little, you know, little more standard Jungian language, the self is getting nourished. Now, I was just trying to put that in a more ordinary speech. Your life's work, which is your purpose for being here, will be facilitated and inspired through this relationship. I'm just saying the same thing in two different ways.
So was he then, in fact, was offering him to drink alcohol in a roundabout way?
In a roundabout way. What's so interesting in the dreams, it will often show that it's not you who are drinking it, but somebody else. And usually that occurs when you feel at odds with what's being asked of you. This is a really complicated point, and not so much complicated intellectually, but complicated emotionally. The underlying, you know, principle here, you probably know it as a phrase: a victory for the self is a defeat for the ego. At the moment, what you're being asked to do feels like a nuisance, anywhere from a nuisance to a horror in the short term. But in the long term, it's a fulfillment of your life. So the difference between your drinking it and the self drinking it would be, if you drank it, you would feel at the moment, oh, this is a cool thing. But when the self drinks it, at the moment, you don't feel that it's a good thing. You feel that it's a sacrifice or a loss. But as you complete it over time, 1, 2, 3, 5, 20 years, depending on its scope, then you start feeling, oh, I'm glad I did that.
And from that conventional standpoint, it looks real.
It looks silly or unpopular or hopeless or a waste of time or humiliating. So, and this is what's so hard about therapy, that, you know, you may have had a rotten life where you had to do things you didn't want. You come into therapy and you're told more things that you don't want to do. And you think, well, you know, how's this different from the way I was raised? And the difference is that what's being given you from this point of view will ultimately be satisfying. But it may take a dark night of the soul before you get there. Like I say, Jung's 15-year journey. That's feeding the self. His ego felt lost and humiliated during that time.
So would you equate that with his relationship that he chose not to have with one form? The fact that it felt like a death to his ego.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
So that it sounds like the relationship with Von Franz was not the end point. The end point was the work that they did there.
Yes, and I think the development of his own heart during the process.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was part of the process.
Okay. I think so. Mm-hmm. And I think they're always the same. I mean, they're always parallel.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Your work and your personal development, when it's from the self, go hand in hand. So that your life becomes your therapist, you might say.
How conscious do you think he was?
I think he must have been intellectually conscious of it, but we'll be seeing now his resistances, which in a way will be frustrating. But on the other hand, you keep seeing how the unconscious will not give up. So you'll see this task presented again and again and again, and it helps us get a clearer picture of it, even though he was intellectually assenting, but I think emotionally he was about 2 years old.
Do you think this situation is that he's asked, the way he's asked to develop and the way he's asked to do the larger work via this relationship, do you think that's a more common way that the self works? I mean,
that's individuation.
Do you think that's parallel? I mean, because I was thinking, you know, it seemed like it paralleled some of his life, a portion of his.
I would say it's typical individuation. There's a sacrifice. There is always a sacrifice. Which, in the long term, is beneficial, but it's not felt that way in the short term.
But a relationship is usually involved.
I think so, yeah.
That is not from the conventional standpoint, it's not it wouldn't be approved.
I wouldn't say that the relationship has to be as problematic as it was for Jung and Pauli. I would say, this is my own personal opinion, that the more world-shaking the product of the creative process, the more it asks the creator to break laws in the area of relationship.
Say that again.
The more important that the creative product is for the health of the civilization, the more likely you are to find that it's involving some sort of mess. I can't think of any great creative person whose life wasn't a mess.
Doing his research into sexual behavior.
He got fired for
Indiana University, they're funding his professorship, blah, blah, blah. So if you keep on the history search, then you're out.
And they did fire him.
Sure. Yeah. So I thought he was driven by this. You know, I think of him when I saw this biography. And the importance of his work, and he was just so brilliant. I mean, all runs got up a car all over the country. And he just had to do this research.
Okay. 67. We've discussed the dream. The only thing I'm going to pick up on is the end. Kepler acted. Similarly, he spends some time on that. Remember, Kepler was one of the very first astronomers to begin formulating the laws of planetary motion. And what that means is the old medieval idea and antique idea of the world being moved by a soul got chopped out of our way of looking at things. So the author just says, that's kind of weird. I mean, Kepler sounds like a bad guy. He is actually contributing to the loss of soul. Because science cannot... what we're calling synchronicity, the Middle Ages would have subsumed under the world soul. That was these marvelous events were indicative of the world having a soul that was alive and was doing things. Well, science says, no, that doesn't exist. And Kepler was one of those guys who says, no, that doesn't exist. What exists are mathematical laws. So, the author says, well, that must not be what the dream is referring to, because the dream is holding up Kepler as a model, as a good guy. And so then he goes on to say how Kepler wanted to be, I think, a Lutheran minister. And couldn't stomach the constricting demands of dogma and of church churchly interpretations. So what he did was seek in his astronomy fulfillment of his religious vocation. And you see that in his I don't know if we talked about this or not. What he said was, you know, it's not that there's a world soul that shows that there's a God. It's that the regularity of the planetary motions are as stable as God's laws. And that's what makes us better people for learning about the laws of the universe. So he threw out the unpredictability. He said the predictability of mathematics is what's divine. And he went on to say, this is not important, but just to give you a feel, if I remember that, let's say geometric shapes had their forms because they were analogous to the forms of God. For example, a sphere was like a point in the sphere was like God. And the circumference of the sphere was like the Father, or maybe it was the other way around, I don't remember. And the distance between the two of them is like the Holy Spirit. So he put a theological interpretation on the laws. Again, not the point, but where our author takes it is that it was trying to show Pauli that his work was become sacred, like Kepler's work became sacred. And in probing the deeper laws of the universe, we would be finding out things about God, just like Kepler thought in probing mathematical laws, he was finding out the lawful, he was substantiating the lawfulness of God. So it puts the work into a religious, makes the work a religious quest. Right. You see, what happened is God became Yahweh. Kepler's God is the Yahweh God. And Newton is the final one. And then if the universe is mathematically lawful, where is there room for synchronicity? There isn't any. That's why it's dismissed. So, when you know, back to Nancy's comment, when they say, oh, it's not scientific, they mean it's not scientific in the Newtonian sense. Because the new physics says we know there are such things as chance events. If there are such things as chance events, that's where we can begin to allow room scientifically for synchronicity. And that was probably what the dream was driving at, for Pauli to realize how the implications of his physics really do bear on theology. and not only on theology abstractly, but on the religious task being placed on him with the presence of von Franz in his life, because that is a synchronicity. That's what he's getting at the end of the dream. Okay? Too abstract, or does that make sense? Makes sense, okay. Now, let's listen to some more Pali BS. Oh, it hasn't come yet. It will be. Just to hear his talk. Until now, I have never had much contact with a woman of my same psychological type. See at the bottom of 67. This gives me a considerable uncertainty when two people make use of the inferior function at the same time. And it's like they both are sitting alone in a car that they can't drive. At least that is how it seems to me, to a certain extent. See, that's the introduction of the value of uncertainty, which is at the heart of quantum mechanics, but introducing it into personal living. And then the sentence I just love, I say that cynically. Do I, in contrast to everyone else around me, really have the effect of generally making women, should be unhappy, sorry. Big typo. Unhappy. I'm trying to give Pally the benefit of the doubt. So, what we're going to be seeing now is the nature of the fragmented personality. We'll see him say one thing one minute, one thing the next, and then do completely the opposite. There is no consistency. So another word for individuation is integrity. That you say pretty much the same thing from one day to the next, and that your actions are in line with your words. So you'll say that one minute, and then the next minute he'll turn around and he'll dump von Franz. It's crazy. That's what craziness is. No connection.
So is this letter to von Franz or to...
No, to Yaffe.
Oh, okay.
At this time, he was also beginning a friendship with Yaffe, who was, I don't know, I didn't know her, but everything I heard, she just seemed to me like sort of a Barbie doll. Whenever there was a conflict at the Institute, and they would always bring her in and say something nice and sweet. And of course, that, you know, that sort of pliable woman would be exactly what Pauli would want. And I can assure you, von Franz was not pliable.
What does he mean by that? He doesn't like them.
He hurts their feelings. Hurts their feelings. Look at the letter then he writes von Franz. I've been thoroughly studying your letter and reflecting on your dreams. This is right on the heels of his comment to Yaffe. First of all, it is important to me that in your dreams you first have adopted me only as a dog. That is, my animal instinctuality that in the previous dream you were not to deal with underneath, but openly across a bridge. Well, what's wrong with that? See, there's nothing wrong with that. She's accepting his instinctual side, and now he's trying to make it a problem. Particularly if you figure he's in a passionless marriage. From that, it seems to me, and I believe we should pay very close attention to this when we are together, that we are to cultivate more the amor coelestis than the amor vulgaris. In other words, spiritual versus physical. Love. Well, Wolfgang, how do you think that made her feel? You see?
Insulted.
And insulted. And just a sentence above, he says, how do I hurt women's feelings? You kill a guy like that.
Some people's perspective of how a professor is supposed to, you know, be tyrannical and that kind of thing.
But he's more than tyrannical, he's fragmented. It's this constant contradiction.
It's almost like he's insulting her instinctuality and her as a person.
Absolutely, he is insulting her instinctuality.
I'm not making people angry. Some professors in general get a great kick out of doing it.
He's probably fragmented ones.
Huh?
I think that usually was some. Did you see that? Did you see that with men? They have glee when they're doing it.
In general, you're saying not just professors.
Oh, yeah. No, sorry. No, there's businessmen who.
But then when you call them on it, they tell me that you're being too sensitive.
Yeah. Start taking things too personally.
Yeah.
Or you just don't
understand. It's emotional abuse.
It really is. I mean, this, I don't want to overstate this, but this carried to its extreme is what produces schizophrenia. This is what the schizogenic parents does. One thing one moment, one thing the next. The kid just checks out and can't take it anymore. Which world do I live in? Now, this is not, but in, you know, we don't use this stuff in Jungian psychology, but if you do read, you know, modern clinical psych, this is what they call the borderline personality. Flip, 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 flip. Your head's just spinning. Two or three contradictory things are said in 3 minutes, and absolute denial that there's a contradiction. And generally an attack when you point out that they just contradicted themselves. That's the way it works.
Because when he says, you first adopt me only as a dog,
yeah.
The power of the recipient.
I imagine she had a dream where, we don't have the dream, where she somehow took in his dog. Which would be a very positive dream, that she's establishing a relationship to his instincts, and wants to.
So she didn't mean he was a dog, it was his dog.
Yeah, that his instinctual side was welcomed in her heart. Mm-hmm.
Well, he clearly understands it, because he says, my animal instinctuality. It's not like he misunderstands that.
Yeah, but you can see he kind of does and he doesn't, all in the same sentence.
Right, right.
That's what's so problematic about these people. Let's see. That I appear as a 9-year-old boy, that would be a little clue. I understand as a judgment from the standpoint of the feeling function, which is indeed my inferior function. There I am, nothing special, but rather undeveloped, perhaps even infantile stock. So you see, if that were a mature reflection, the next comment would have been, now how am I doing that to you? So he's just playing with this stuff. And it never follows through, or rarely follows through, from this point.
And you know, that's amazing to me, because he's so rational and logical, you know, on the thinking side.
Right.
And to be that much different, I mean, that's like a world of crazy.
Compartments. This is what Jung calls compartment psychology. One set of rules reign in one area, and another set of rules reign in the other area. And the success of therapy with somebody like that is, can one side begin to see the other? And again, if that statement at the top of the page were honest, he would have asked her, how am I hurting your feelings? Tell me. But he doesn't. He ends with, remember the uncommitted archetypal thinking? It's your inferior function. Yeah. But where is it operating? So he thinks in a way to avoid commitment emotionally.
synergy and uncommitted.
Archetypal thinking. The archetypal isn't so obvious here, but the uncommitted thinking. It, thinking is used to avoid commitment. And boy, in therapy, that is hell to deal with. Because they are so good at communicating and seeming to hold a coherent conversation, but all the while it's a lie. Because the emotional truth is being destroyed.
He's using his education and
yeah, to protect and really hurt somebody.
And somebody like that can really do it.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. Probably, I'm guessing one of the reasons he stayed fascinated with her was she herself was brilliant, and I'm sure she gave him a run for his money.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it
he's still
king of the woodpile.
Outmaneuver here, which is very tragic.
Yeah. The veto has the final power. So again, I don't say this to get you sour on this work, but that we can really begin to look at what pathology is, how the unconscious is now going to try to address that. He may not make progress in that, but it doesn't mean we can't learn from it. That's why I feel it's worth keeping our attention to these dreams, but also facing squarely who it is we're dealing with.
And maybe just say that again. He uses thinking to remain uncommitted. Or
yeah, yeah. To keep the issue of emotional
avoid
the emotional reality and commitment.
And this is all from the unconscious.
Well, in a person like this, one part of the sentence may be from the conscious, and the next part of the sentence may be from the unconscious.
And nevertheless, sounding manipulation.
It is manipulation, right. So, you know, when he says, do I really have the effect of making women unhappy? That could be a conscious statement. But soon as he's up against an unhappy woman, he will not remember he said that and say to her, how have I hurt your feelings? And even with the dog bit, she probably did have a dream that she adopted his dog. And so that part of the statement is correct. Only is probably not correct. So within a sentence, there are words that are correct, and there are words that are incorrect.
The contradictions.
And that's how quickly the flip between the conscious and the unconscious occur with some of these people. And if you try to discuss it, they will say, well, yeah, but I said I accept that she's accepting my dog. Yeah, but you said holy. Oh, yeah, but that's not important. Don't make such a deal. It's only a word. What's wrong with you? You sound just like my parents. And that's the way it goes. You generally just have to sit back and wait until fate hits them in a way that opens them up. Sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't.
So are you saying something?
Oh, definitely. If you, you know, again, we don't use this language for good reasons, but if you gave him a contemporary diagnosis, I think he'd be a high-functioning borderline.
And if for people who are brilliant at that level in one area, and they're not, you know, they're not, don't you think that you see that more of that?
I haven't known that many people. I don't think necessarily. You know, there's Niels Bohr, who, by all accounts, was just a loving husband, a loving father, a supportive teacher. And, you know, he was certainly, if not as, nearly as brilliant as Pally. I mean, he started the whole thing. I don't think it has to be that way.
But does his nationality have anything to do with it? I have a son-in-law, and he just work. He's back in the office,
yeah,
writing all the time. And when Harry Met Sally, that old movie, he went to that, and he said, "Oh well," he said, "we historians don't need all that. Whatever so we call it, some kind of fuzzy, warm fuzzy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We don't, you know." And if you do get him to go to the movie, he goes to sleep.
And he's just, and Barbara says that Germans live to work where we work.
Yeah, well, I'm half German, so I've looked at this, and I think they're, you know, it's a very problematic culture.
Okay.
I know my analyst who was, I think I heard her say two negative things in 8 years. The one negative thing she said, the Germans have a feeling problem that will never be healed.
Oh, okay. Excellent.
I don't know. I know some fantastic Germans.
Oh, yeah, and
but
underneath that.
Maybe as a generalization.
Yeah, underneath
there's a huge feeling.
Very,
yeah. I actually saw in Germany a cripple crossing the road and a car sitting at the intersection, laying on the horn, get out of my way. I saw that.
And yet, the influence out in one of the books that we were going back, I guess in starting off in the 1800s, that mythology was an integral part of the education. But I guess that didn't move forward to that extent. That philosophy had failed, and, you know, religion had failed, and that the mythology, the German myth, and he gives some of those, I thought was really moving.
I don't want to be unfair to them. As I say, I knew some fantastic, really amazingly sensitive and thoughtful people, but we're talking here in general.
Like, yeah, no, I know.
I think in general what he felt about the Germans was that he put it at the hands of Christianity. That they were, the other parts of Europe were Christianized very early and had a time to assimilate it. The Germans, having a warlike mythology anyway, if you read, you know, their myths, it's very, very warlike, that when Christianity came in, it just slapped a veneer over the real nature of the Germans and quieted them down, but that the demons were still very much under the surface. And so that rationality is an attempt to keep control of what, of that national spirit was not allowed to fulfill itself, thanks to the light and moralistic thrust of Christian conversions. Let's take a break. We're a little bit over time.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I will say it's also true, though. I mean, I know people like that. And they're not extreme like that.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, on a continuum, yeah. I think this is a pattern of behavior that people exhibit. And I wouldn't call them borderline, but it is sort of their M.O.
Well, if it's their M.O., by DSM-3 or 4, whatever it is, things, they're borderline.
Yeah, I don't know. I think people, maybe to lesser degrees than him, can be like this. Their feelings can become their thinking. They don't realize that there's a difference between the two. Their thinking.
Well, the key here, however, is the flip-flop. Where it's consistent, it would not be this situation.
Well, I think what you're saying too, you they would ask if their feelings would come out in an ethical way. They would ask what their impact is on
right.
the person.
It's the absence of continuity, which is so scary. Mm. Like, you know, modern psychology divides people up into basically two camps: narcissists and borderlines. A narcissist would never say, "Do I make you unhappy?" and continue in the coldness without any contradiction. In other words, they are always creeps, and it doesn't bother them. Where a borderline will flip. There will be an approach at one moment, and then a flip back at the next. Where if he were a narcissist, he would say, well, I make women unhappy, so what? And then go on. But the other side flips back and forth. Okay, that's a stretch.